Well, you know, I wasn't tired this morning until Lynn Black shared what I do in the average week. And I had no idea that he had gotten information from Marcia about that. And I thought, I feel kind of tired now. But ready to start a new series with you today. Tomorrow's going to be a big day, of course. The last time I was in a total solar eclipse, I was 7 years old. And our parents made safe viewing lenses. That was before Amazon.com, when you had to learn. How many of you had to learn to make things like that for yourself back in the day? You learned how to do that. So we had homemade viewing lenses. And at the time of day when it was to start, our parents got us out in the yard. We started looking at it, and you could just begin to see a bare shaded sliver going across the sun. But now this whole thing was way too slow for a seven-year-old, so I'd have to get on my bike and ride around, and then my dad would say, come back now, come look at this, and then it was about half covered, and then a little while later, you saw it, it completely covered it. What I remember about the experience is when there was this darkness, kind of like twilight, everything grew quiet and calm. At first, crickets started chirping, thinking it was evening. But then that went away. We'll get to experience this tomorrow. Hopefully, we're going to have a clear day, and the sun will be shining. And you're invited, if you need a good viewing area, to come to the parking lot. We're going to have it open at noon. You can come, bring some chairs to sit. We're going to have our own St. Luke's viewing glasses to use. We've got, I think, like 1,000 of them. So we will give those out until they run out. So we'll have a pair of glasses for you to wear tomorrow so you can see this. We'll experience it for ourselves. But the reason I'm telling you this morning is not because I'm preaching on the eclipse. It's to point out that when there's an abnormal darkness, it can be unnerving. It's like all of creation understands this. When light is being blocked, there's a feeling that something's wrong. Light is helpful. Light is hopeful. Light is healing. And when light is blocked, something's wrong. No wonder the Bible puts spiritual contrast in terms of light and darkness. Last Sunday for the sunrise service, Pastor Jen did a beautiful job of reminding us how light and darkness run as a theme through the whole Bible, beginning with the first act of creation, light that came into darkness, to the very last event at the end of Revelation, light that permanently dispels darkness. And in the middle of that story is Jesus, who comes as the light of the world. No wonder in the Gospel of Matthew that with the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, Matthew relates this event to the prophecy of Isaiah, who said, "The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned." The message is clear. Jesus dawns new light of hope for people. That is God's great mission, to bring light and hope to people. Now, I want us to park that idea for just a minute, and we're going to come back to it. I want to turn and talk about a series that we're beginning today called Ancestry.UMC. We're going to be digging for 3 weeks into the DNA of our United Methodist Church. Methodism, of course, started in England under John Wesley, but it happened here in America under the leadership of our first bishop, Francis Asbury. John Wesley gets a lot of attention. Francis Asbury doesn't get as much, but without Francis Asbury, there's probably not a United Methodist Church today, at least nothing like what we look like. Now, why are we going to talk about Francis Asbury and American Methodists? That's about as interesting as paint drying on the wall. I understand that. But 3 weeks from Tuesday, we're going to begin the most significant general conference in the history of our Methodist Church. we will hopefully remove discriminatory, harmful language toward LGBTQ plus members in our denomination. And we may be facing legislation that's going to restructure our global church and even more. So I thought as we get ready for this, we might dig back into our history a little bit and think about who are we called to be and where are we going? That's what people ask today. What is the future of our United Methodist Church? Well, all we need to do is understand our history to get a hold of our future. Last year, I read a book about the life of Francis Asbury that really was the inspiration for this. It's called American Saint. It's a great book that covers not just the history of Francis Asbury Methodism, but America in the 1700s and the early 1800s. Let me give you some quick history on Francis Asbury. He was born in the Midlands of England in a very poor family. He had to drop out of school as a boy, which was not unusual for poor children back then if they didn't have the funds to continue their education. He went to work as an apprentice for a tradesman of some sort, and apparently he was around some pretty rough characters, and it would appear that his life was headed on a not-so-promising future. But a man who we do not know his name came into his life, a Methodist man, who sort of took young Francis Asbury under his wing and brought him to a Methodist gathering. And in a period of the boy's life when there was sort of this developing darkness, he heard a message of hope that his life was of value, that it mattered to a God who sent his son Jesus Christ for him. And he gave his life to Christ at age 13. And he continued in these Methodist gatherings. He began to lead prayers and a leadership at Methodist worship services. By 21, he became a circuit-riding preacher for John Wesley. And by the age of 26, he raised his hand to volunteer when John Wesley said, "Who would go to lead the American circuit?" There were 200 Methodists in America at that time. Francis Asbury said, "Send me. I'll go." Now, Wesley sent some others too. But when the Revolutionary War broke out, the others went home because if you're a British citizen, you had to return or you would be viewed as a traitor and your life would be in jeopardy. Well, that's what happened to Francis Asbury. He was so committed to the cause in America, he refused to go home. He never went back to England. Again, there are great stories of Methodist families hiding him in their cellar to protect him from British soldiers. But after the war, because of his commitment to the people, when Methodism first became a separate church from the Church of England, in 1784, they elected Francis Asbury as the first bishop. In his life, he rode some 130,000 miles on horseback. When he came here, there were a few hundred Methodists. By his death in 1816, there were a few hundred thousand Methodists. In this autobiography, it says that due to his leadership and influence, Methodism was the largest and most influential religious group in America from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War. That's because of Francis Asbury. But here's the inspiration for this sermon series. At the end of his life, when he knew he was in his last days, but he still had enough energy to go do a few things, it says he was determined to do three things: preach, collect money for the poor, and visit old friends. Each was, in its own way, an expression of his faith. When I read that, I thought, that's our DNA right there. That's our DNA as Methodists. To preach. To care about the suffering of our world. And to be a people who are connected to one another and to people beyond the church. So that's what we're going to talk about for 3 weeks. And we start today with preaching. There were four characteristics of early Methodist preaching. One of them was that Methodists emphasized grace. Rather than tell people what they must do, Methodists emphasized what God has done, that the gospel begins with the activity of God, not what we do. Methodist preaching also lifted up the good possibilities within people. Rather than harping on what's wrong with us, Methodist preaching focused on our redemptive potential and what God can do for us. One of Francis Asbury, one of his contemporaries, was a man named Thomas Rankin. Rankin would focus on what's wrong with people, and one day he got a letter from John Wesley that said, "You must not focus on people's fallenness." He reminded him not to tell people continually, "You are dead, for it will make it so." I love that. Methodist preaching also emphasized response, human response. Wesley would say it's like being, it's like drowning in a body of water and somebody throws you a preserver or a rope. That's life-saving only if you grab it. You must respond to the offer of grace. And then Methodist preaching brought conviction that the promises of God are real. Wesley emphasized experience in human understanding of faith. There must be the experience of the truth. And so for his preachers, he would ask them, "Have you experienced what you're talking about?" Because people must know that what we believe is a real thing, that God is present, that God is real. Now, beyond the substance of this preaching, perhaps the most important part of Methodist preaching is that we took it to the people. John Wesley himself preached in the coal mines and in the factories where the church had abandoned folks, where the church was just fine not to include certain numbers of the population. And so Methodist, and they continued this under Francis Asbury in America, would take the church out to where the people are. Their very action let them know that there is a God who cares about them and wants to reach out to them. Now, this wasn't new. It was New Testament. It's what the Apostle Paul did, and this brings us back now to our theme of light and darkness. Paul said in 2 Corinthians, "For it is the God who said, 'Light will shine out of darkness,' who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Paul went beyond the bounds of Judaism to take the gospel to Gentiles, who said, "In any darkness you're facing, you do have light." Now, Paul paid a price. He was often attacked for this action, and so were Methodists. Methodists were often attacked for taking the gospel out to where people are. Some years ago, we took a St. Luke's tour to England of early Methodist history. We went to a museum in Bristol. Pastor Mindy was a part of that trip. She got some pictures of examples of the kind of attack that Methodists went through. There's a picture in one place here. I think we have. There we go. Let me read it because I know it's hard to see. It says, "Don't be deceived. These Methodists use religion as a cloak to cover sexual license." Well, that would probably attract a lot of people, I'm afraid. "Great numbers of persons of both sexes frequently assemble in the night, the doors for the most part being locked, barred, and bolted. To these private assemblies, none are admitted without tickets." Why is it that grace can become controversial? Why is it? It still is. There are factions of United Methodists, and mostly now former United Methodists, who continue to attack the United Methodist Church, who say, "Be careful if you strike the language in our discipline that excludes gay and lesbian people. You just wait now. Before you know it, the cross is going to go away. You just wait. They're going to stop preaching Jesus. You just wait. They won't even use the Bible anymore." I don't know why it is, but the real message of grace is always challenging to some. But it is our DNA to face the challenge, to bolster the courage, to go no matter the attack, to let people know, just like a young Frances Asbury, that their life matters to God. And because of that, it matters to us. We must go. And that means we all are preachers. We all are preachers. Have you ever thought of yourself as a preacher? I'm not talking about the way you might address shortcomings with your spouse. I'm talking about being a preacher of the gospel. Most of us probably would say, no, that is in no way a way I would refer to myself. Preaching is what I'm doing right now. It's for a certain number of people who stand before the congregation, who've been to seminary, who wear stoles and robes. Those are the preachers. Those are just a small number of the preachers. We are all called to be dispensers of grace. We are all called to carry the message of hope to people in some way. And God uses us for that. Let me give you a little example of what I'm talking about. Jenny Godby has been a member of St. Luke's for a number of years now. Jenny, of course, brought her husband, Tom Godby, into St. Luke's, which, for those of you who know Tom, was a day that shall live in infamy. Here's how Jenny came to be a St. Luke's member. Jenny, many years ago, was going through a period of life that she would say was a dark time. She was lost. She was without a great deal of hope. She was struggling. She was a single mom working 3 to 4 jobs. One of those jobs was working in a doctor's office, Dr. Thomas Moore, who was a member of St. Luke's. He would help Jenny out because he cared about her. He would support her. But one day, he decided that she needed a support that was more than just an occasional gift of money or something. He said, I know you need some help. I'm going to write you a prescription. He pulled out his prescription tab, and he wrote down, and he tore it, and he handed it to her. She thought, well, I guess I'm heading to the pharmacy to get some medicine, and she read it. Go to St. Luke's. He said, Jenny, if you'll come to St. Luke's, my wife and I will take you and the kids out for brunch after church. He knew that what she needed was not medicine for the body, but medicine for the soul. And Jenny said it was a life changer. That was when we were worshiping Justin Robertson Chapel. Jenny said these words to me when I called to make sure she wouldn't mind me sharing this again. She said, yep, sitting in Robertson Chapel listening to Carver McGriff every Sunday. She goes, my tears on those pews are now a part of the DNA of St. Luke's. You've got some tears there too for some of you. That's what it looks like to preach. To understand I've got a congregation of patients who come to see me, that I can offer the invitation of hope. What's your congregation? Maybe you're a doctor. Maybe you have patients. Maybe you have clients. Maybe you've got colleagues, family, neighbors, friends, on and on it goes. God gives every one of us a congregation of people with whom we can use our influence and the trust that we've built with people when we know they're in a dark place, to become an invitation of light and hope. Our DNA, even when it becomes radical to do so, is to be preachers to the very end, just like Frances Asbury. As a Protestant church, we recognize two sacraments, communion and baptism. They are symbols of grace. You could say preaching in many ways is a sacrament. In the act of this sharing of words, God's grace gets in the middle of it mysteriously to work as God will. We are called to be living sacraments to people. Just as we receive the gift of Jesus Christ given to you and me for forgiveness because God says you're worth redeeming. No matter what you've done to mess up your life, you're worth forgiveness and a new start that God wants to make of us an embodiment of that invitation for others. So let us